It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. With the recent assisted suicide of Brittany Maynard in Oregon and renewed conversations on dying with dignity, we wanted to talk about how the conversations on death and dying are changing or need to change. Even before the talk turns to assisted suicide, how can quality of life be better for people who are terminally ill? How do conversations need to be when it comes to the end of life care? I'm joined in Studio A by Dr. Robert Arnold, a professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh and medical director at UPMC's Palliative and Supportive Institute. Dr. Arnold, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And we'd like to hear from you. When it comes to terminal illness, how can patient, doctor, family, end of life care conversations be better? And with national polls putting public support for aid in dying at 70%, where do you stand on the patient's right to die? You can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter, at esspgh, hashtag EPLive. And we'll start with this tweet from Nettie, who says, I would spare my family and friends the pain of watching me suffer and fade away. I'd like to leave them with good memories. Again, if you want to reach us on Twitter, ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Dr. Arnold, let's start with a definition of the term dying with dignity. How do you define it?
So I'm not sure what the term means, and I guess for most people, you know, in America, they're not dying until very, very late in the game. For most Americans, the traditional person is 75, 80, 90 years old, has multiple sicknesses, has heart disease, has some diabetes, has problems with their breathing. And in fact, they go through an 8 to 12 year process of having chronic illnesses that could end their life and not being sure when they end their life. And so one of the problems for doctors is talking of terminally ill and dying for things other than cancer is really hard. So as a palliative care doctor, my job is to help their primary doctors do a better job of decreasing the burdens of their illness and improving the quality of their life.
And are public attitudes toward this idea of dying with dignity, is it changing? Are the attitudes changing? And if so, why?
Well, I think the attitudes of how well our health system takes care of chronically seriously ill patients are changing because many of us boomers have parents who have been through the process, and we found out that it doesn't work very well. If you blog palliative care, if you read blogs about people whose loved one died of Alzheimer's or their loved one died of cancer, and what they find is a disjointed medical system that really doesn't focus on their goals and their needs, and it feels like you're adrift in the system. And so I think that people are saying we have to do better. If the good side of medicine is we've prolonged lives, the bad side is we're not so good at dealing with the multiple sicknesses that people still live with.
So what needs to change?
I think what we need to change is as people get older, we need to realize that our goals in the last part of our lives aren't the same as the goals in the first part of our lives. I liken it to a football game because Pittsburghers love their football. The way that Tomlin coaches the first quarter is different than the way that he coaches the last 2 minutes. And so we need to begin to have discussions about what's most important in those last years when you have multiple illnesses and we can't fix everything.
So you're saying that the problems that you've identified here, that it has to do with communication.
A lot of it has to do with communication with doctors, between doctors, communication of patients and their doctors, a societal communication about the fact that regardless of how great medicine is, that we can't prolong people's lives indefinitely, and a question of when you're 90 years old, when you're 80 years old and you have multiple comorbidities and you're sick, what's most important? For some people, it's not going back to the hospital every time. For other people, it's making sure that their symptoms are well treated. For the person whose tweet you read, it was making sure that their family didn't suffer and we did a better job of supporting their family.
412-246-2002 if you would like to join our conversation with Dr. Robert Arnold, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh and medical director at UPMC's Palliative and Supportive Institute. Let's go to the phones. We have Brian in Penn Township. Brian, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have kind of a unique perspective in that I, for 8 or 9 years of my career, worked both in hospice and then also in a hospital and intensive care and oncology units. And, you know, I've seen death. I've seen where hospice and palliative care can really provide a good death for someone with lots of dignity and minimal suffering. I've also seen death where, despite the best efforts of hospice and palliative care, people die with a lack of dignity, with pain, with suffering, whether physical or emotional, spiritual. And, you know, having had that experience, I know for me, for my own life, there are certain diagnoses, if I get them, and this is something my family knows, I will choose to end my life on my own terms rather than go through the indignities of dying in certain from certain diseases. And, you know, certainly I can do that on my own, but the idea of being able to have that conversation with my physician and that being a collaborative process with a physician, to me, feels much more compassionate and much more of the way it should be done. And so I'm really just calling to speak from my own experience in favor of compassionate assistance for terminally ill suffering people who want to die.
Dr. Arnold, what about the points that Brian is bringing up here?
So I think that we have pretty good data from Oregon where there's that experience. I think that having that on the table is something that may help and may not help. I think that there are a lot of social questions that need to be answered. So Brian may have a good point. It may be that the social impact decreases it. I think the thing to remember is that even in Oregon, the number of people who ask for aid in dying is very, very small. So as a society, if we're going to spend our time and energy, we ought to focus it on trying to improve the care of all our elderly or all people who have a life-limiting illness rather than focus on the 50 who choose or don't choose assisted suicide.
Let's talk about living wills. How can a living will or advanced directives influence a patient's quality of life?
So I think it's hard to talk to people about this issue. And what a living will really does is lets your family know what your values are and what's important if you should get really, really sick. For example, what I hear Brian saying is if I get certain illnesses, don't do anything to make it last longer. If I get a pneumonia, that's a relief. Just make sure that I'm comfortable. If I stop eating, don't look at putting artificial nutrition. Just make sure that I'm comfortable. That is, his family doesn't have to say, gee, I wonder what Brian would have said. You know, there's part of him that say this, and there are families who have different views about it. It's a way to give his family the peace of mind to know exactly what his views are so that they're not trying to guess what your values are. And there is data that that makes it more helpful for families.
So you're saying that for the vast number of people, certainly more than those who are directly affected by the right to commit doctor-assisted suicide, that for the people who are just dealing with the end-of-life issues, the terminal illnesses, that the best thing to do is to be proactive and
make it easy for your family. Mm-hmm. It's both so that you don't have to go through things that are against your values or cause suffering that you wouldn't want. It also makes it so much easier for your kids when I'm seeing a family and I say, what would your dad say? And they say, oh, our dad told us exactly what his views were. His values were what he enjoyed doing. This is what he thought a life was worth living. If he got like this, he would just find that intolerable. And then I can say, here are the medical treatments that make sense or don't make sense.
Are there more people making living wills? Is there more of a push for this than in the past?
There's clearly a push for it. There is a, you know, when you come in the hospital asks you every time you're admitted if you have one. There are many organizations around the country who are urging doctors to have these conversations. There's, again, federal legislation, which is a great idea to sort of help doctors sort of do it and get funded for doing it, get paid, which doctors think is a good idea. So, and the AARP says that patients should have this discussion. Most, you know, if you get a regular will done, your lawyer will talk to you about this. There are national campaigns. Ellen Goodman, who's a writer for the Boston Globe, has started something called the Conversation Project. There are projects in Seattle where people get together for dinner or urging that for Thanksgiving, which is just coming up, and everyone's sitting around the house, that you should say, hey, Mom, I just want to make sure that I really understand what's important to you as you get older so that I can be a good advocate for you. Or the mom should say, hey, kids, you know, I'm 90 years old. I hope I have another 10 great years. And I want to make sure that if I ever get sick and can't talk to my doctors, you know what's important.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation. We are with Dr. Robert Arnold, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh and medical director at UPMC's Palliative and Supportive Institute. 412-246-2002 with your questions and comments. Thanks again to Brian for joining the conversation. Also, you can reach us via email at ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH, #EPLive. We asked the question on Twitter, have you been with a loved one through their final days? Was the end-of-life care everything that you would have hoped? Daryl says, our entire family, 6 children, 17 grandchildren, was with my grandpa as he died on October 21st. End-of-life care was comforting. The process only took 3 days, relatively quick. That being said, I hope assisted suicide becomes legal nationwide. So we're having these parallel conversations about, you know, what you just talked about, doctor, about the wishes of our parents or our grandparents or older relatives, or perhaps even our brothers and sisters about the care they would want if, hopefully not, but if they run into a situation like Brittany Maynard's in Oregon, how would they want to be cared for? What are their wishes if they are unable to articulate them? But this other issue, and because it's fresh in our minds, it just happened this week. Brittany Maynard committed the assisted suicide. She's being criticized in some circles, and we'll get to that. But this is something people – it's really made an impression with people. Can it serve to at least get us – talking about these issues?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, regardless of what you think about Brittany Maynard's decision, I have sympathy for her and her family and condolences and sympathy for them and the sort of bravery she had for at least talking about it. There is some evidence that in Oregon, which is a particular kind of state with a particular racial homogeneity and socioeconomic homogeneity, that it did catalyze a discussion in that state about good palliative care, about being appropriate and being better at doing pain management and symptom management and getting people to have the discussions. If we could be sure that every state was like Oregon, it might make our lives easier. There is much more homogeneity both in social economic status and in race in much of the rest of the country. And I think that it's okay for the country to have experiments as long as we spend 90% of our time focusing on the great experience that your previous caller had, which is not the national norm. If you look at the Center to Advance Palliative Care and you look at their ratings of states for how good we're doing in providing good palliative care, we're not doing great as a country. The Institute of Medicine just had a national report basically saying we weren't having a national conversation, that healthcare providers weren't well trained, that the conversations weren't happening. And so I think if we're going to spend our limited national energy on a discourse, it's how do we do better for the, you know, the growing number of elderly people who have multiple morbidities.
And it sounds like what you're saying is it's a matter of the individuals directly affected by this, the person who is aging saying, as you indicated earlier, initiating the conversation about here's what I want. But you're also – it sounds like you're saying that medical professionals need to – there needs to be some sort of an intervention on the part of medical professionals to say you really ought to be having this conversation with your – with your parents or with your children.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, for example, one of my colleagues, Jane Shells, who's a nephrologist, did a nephrology fellowship where the life expectancy on dialysis is, 3 to 5 years, and didn't get any formal training in how to talk to patients about that. Oncology, oncologists in the world, if you go back a generation, you ask them, how much training did you get talking about these issues? They reported that the thing that was most influential in their training was a bad experience. That isn't those aren't the skills that doctors need to have to have these conversations.
Are we just assuming that they do have these skills when in fact, in many cases, they do not?
Well, we know they don't. I mean, we've done research. I have colleagues at Duke who have done research. It's not an intuitive skill.
Right. And are we as patients saying, or as we who are coming to these medical professionals, are we just assuming that, oh, they'll tell us, we'll get it from them?
I think we're assuming that it's black and white. We're assuming we're either doing okay or we're dying. And in fact, that isn't how death occurs in America. Death doesn't occur that one day you're healthy and the next day you're terminally ill. For most diseases, again, other than cancer, and even cancer is turning into a chronic disease, you live with the disease that will take your life for a decade. So it isn't like you have heart failure, you're dying. You have heart failure. You go into the hospital, you have heart failure. You go home, you come back into the hospital a couple years later, their heart failure is a little worse. You go on new medicine. You're a little less able to do things at home. You come back into the hospital. So there's this up and down trajectory that make it hard to know exactly when, which is why you need to begin to talk about it. And we need to talk about prognosis. What are most people's lives like? So that people can better predict, people can better sort of plan for what their futures may be like.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Arnold here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Again, Dr. Arnold, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, medical director at UPMC's Palliative and Supportive Institute. Let's get to some calls. Let's start with Rudy in Greensburg. Rudy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Dr. Arnold.
Hi, how are you guys doing today? Just a couple comments. One of the things I've experienced, and I've been an RN for over 21 years and in healthcare for over 30, lately, whenever we developed the pulse to our version of the living will that we have in Pennsylvania that we can do so easily, many times whenever I've worked, we've had people come on through and just override a pulse. They'll just turn around and basically say, no, do whatever you have to do to save mom or dad, regardless of what their condition is and regardless of what their wishes were, which sometimes is very troubling. So that's pretty much all that I had to say on that. Thank you.
Okay. Rudy, your thoughts about Rudy's comments?
I think that the thing that healthcare providers need to remember and the thing that sort of makes this really clear is that these are sad conversations. And that emotions, when we're emotional, we often don't say what we really think. And that one of the things that healthcare providers need to be able to do is better deal with the sadness that people come to these conversations. Because when someone says to me, don't do what my mom would want, that you can't let her die, you could say, well, okay. You could also say, I can see how sad this is for you. I can see how overwhelming it is. That is, doctors and nurses who are pretty, cognitively brained, I mean, to get through medical school and nursing school, you got to do a lot of studying, often hear what I would call emotions as cognition. I also think that there's a certain sense in which we need to be clear that, pulse are orders. This was what your mom had told us, we really need to respect it. I know how sad this makes you. I can see how upsetting this is.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Melinda in Pittsburgh. Melinda, Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. My situation was sort of the opposite with my mother. We had spoken with her about her desires and needs, and my brothers and I were frustrated at several points that the medical care folks we were working with, who were very caring, we would say point blank, like, are we moving toward death? Is she moving toward death? Is it time to go to palliative care? And it felt like no one was willing to be candid back to us, even though we were trying to support my mother and her wishes, which we had talked about years in advance.
So you're saying you did not get the support for end-of-life care from the medical community?
No, we were asking point blank, is she at the point where we can say she is actively, not actively dying in a medical sense, but that she is dying or that she will not recover from this illness? And no one was willing to sort of say, yes, let's look at her wishes and see how we can best ease her out of this life.
Yeah, I feel bad for you. That's a sad story. I also think it's hard. You know, I have sympathy. I have sympathy for everybody in this situation because what the doctors would say is, well, she had an infection. If we give her antibiotics, she might be able to get a little better. So I can't tell you exactly. And that's part of what makes it so hard for you to advocate. And it's why palliative care as a medical discipline has sort of sprung up that, for example, at all the UPMC hospitals now, there are subspecialists who sort of work with the doctors to try to tease out not just dying. What was your mom trying to avoid?
We would have loved to have worked with somebody. Like, I think that's fantastic. We would have been thrilled to work with somebody who we could work with our medical care providers. We could work with a palliative care, you know, person and really make sure we were honoring what she wanted. So I feel like we went to palliative care, boy, maybe a week or two later than we needed to. And we were ready for the candor, and we heard back from her medical team, like, most people are the emotional, you know, that is a very difficult conversation to have about a family member. So there's two sides. I think we need to be honest with ourselves that we do need to take care of our family members in those situations, and the medical community can help us with that on the emotional side. And then on the this is happening. Let's be honest.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melinda. Let's go to Marcy in Squirrel Hill. Marcy, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Dr. Robert Arnold.
Thank you for your show. You have the best show, and thank you for the opportunity to ask my question. My question has to do with a person with dementia who has expressed in the past a desire to not live too long and not live too long with dementia about discontinuing medications, especially if the person is hospitalized or in a facility. How reasonable is it just to discontinue all the medications except for maybe pain medicine or medicine that's helping with comfort? And how do you get that done if you know that that's what the person wants?
So I should be careful talking on the radio, giving medical advice. So I want to first say I can answer in generalities, and then I can give you something to do at the end.
Okay.
If your view is my mom had told me or my loved one had been really, really clear, I would go talk to the doctor and say, you know, these medicines aren't achieving their goal. I wonder if we can stop them, because she was really clear this would not be – continued existence wouldn't be a good thing. She wouldn't be happy about this. And I think a lot of doctors will be more than willing to have that conversation with you. It's entirely reasonable. The reason you give medicines is to achieve health outcomes that then translate into helping people achieve their goals. If what I'm hearing you say is these medicines aren't going to help achieve her goals, living longer would no longer have been her goal or his goal, then I, in fact, think it's reasonable to stop the medicines. I would also tell you that many nursing homes have geriatric palliative care nurse practitioners in them. This is a project that one of my colleagues has done and has gotten a multi-million dollar federal grant for, called RAVEN. And I would ask the nursing home, if that wasn't very helpful, if you could either talk to one of the nurse practitioners or ask for a consult to go to an outpatient palliative care doctor.
Thank you.
Does that help, Marcy?
Yes, it Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling and for listening. Let's take another call from Jane in South Hills. Jane, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with Dr. Robert Arnold.
Hello?
Hi, Jane. Yep.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Dr. Arnold. I applaud your work. I just wanted to make a comment regarding what happened to my mom. And this was 7 years ago, so things might be a little bit different now. But she had esophageal cancer. She had care, chemo, radiation, and surgery up here. She went back to her home in Florida and got some more chemo. But prior to doing anything with her oncologist in Florida, she said to him, I want to live, but if I can't, you know, if it's not working, then I want to go on hospice. I mean, she laid it flat out for him. And do you know that when it came time for her to have hospice, he said to her, you know, there's other chemos that we can try. And all I could think was that he wanted to do that because he was making money by doing the chemo, and he wasn't going to make any money by having her go into hospice. Can you just comment on that? Are the doctors still incentivized to treat and attempt to cure when there's no way it's going to happen?
So first, I have again, I apologize for the bad experience that you have, and I'm sorry for your loss. I think that our incentives are still not matched in the healthcare system. So people are reimbursed for things for doing rather than having conversations. Having said that, I have to say that I work with a lot of oncologists at the Hillman Cancer Center, and they are in general extraordinarily hardworking and want to do the right thing for patients nationally. The American Cancer Society has been working with a nonprofit group that I work with called Vital Talk to teach oncologists across the country how to better have these conversations. And the American Society of Clinical Oncology is spending a lot of their time and energy trying to do a better job of teaching palliative care. So hopefully families that have a loved one that tragically has esophageal cancer next year won't have the same experience that you had.
Thank you, Jane. And let's take one last call from a person identifying themselves as Dr. Chris driving to the airport. Dr. Chris, you're on with Dr. Arnold. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Dr. Arnold, thank you very much for having this conversation. I think it's a needed conversation. You know, as a psychologist, one of the things that we deal with quite a bit is people with chronic diseases, and whether it be palliative or you know, pretty end-stage type stuff. And I think you're absolutely right in one respect that, you know, physicians in general, and all on stereotype, but a lot of them have a hard time having those hard conversations. They're simply not trained to do it. Yes, they're doctors, and, you know, cognitively they have to get through medical school, like you said, but, again, they're human beings, and those are hard conversations to have, and they're simply not trained a lot of times to have those conversations because it's hard for them to deal with the emotions themselves. I also would like to say that, you know, I agree and disagree with you on the palliative side, you know, putting more effort into that. I agree wholeheartedly that needs to be done. But I also need to think that, you know, the other option is viable. You know, you said that people are living longer with certain types of cancers, but the reality is there are still a lot of diseases out there that are very painful, palliative care or not. Pancreatic, liver, esophageal, stomach cancers, for example, are horrible diseases. And I think, you know, the public should have that option, and it should be discussed. I think one of the reasons people don't utilize that more is because socially it's still very unacceptable. But again, that's all I have to say. Thank you so much for having the conversation. I'm glad somebody's finally having it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Chris, and careful driving there as you.
Yeah, I was a little worried about him him driving on to the airport. I hope he has those hands-free ones.
It sounded like he might have been on a hands-free device. We'll hope that he was. To his points, quickly, as we need to wrap this up here with about a minute left.
So I think that he's right. We need to do better training for doctors, both how to handle their own emotions, which are completely human. I also think that palliative care can be in concert with advances in medicine, and so we need to have better palliative care as well as better things to treat pain. We don't spend enough money on how to do better with treating pain. And I think that I'm going to sort of not make a comment on the sort of legality of physician aid in dying.
Well, that was going to be my last question. Should Pennsylvania at least give consideration? Should we have a conversation about legalizing life-ending medication prescribed by a doctor for certain terminally ill patients?
I think that we should first have a conversation about the fact that everybody in Pennsylvania is going, unfortunately, to die. And how can we provide better care to make their last years of their life have a better quality of life and make sure that their values are listened to? Then we can have that conversation.
Dr. Robert Arnold is a professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh and medical director at UPMC's Palliative and Supportive Institute. Dr. Arnold, thanks for being with us on Essential
thanks.
Pittsburgh.
You're a great interviewer.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Coming up, rethinking our attitudes on aging, it's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.